Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's Alan Chartok, and it's the Capital Connection. Joining us this week is the man with the best name in all organized journalism, Yancey Roy, the Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday. Welcome, Yancey.
Thanks, Alan.
Well, Yancey, things are getting to the end of the session, or as we academics say, the end of the semester. And I'm wondering about a whole bunch of things. Is there going to be an ethics reform?
Well, the legislators keep saying that they're working towards it. And this, of course, is in the face of all the scandals that we have going, the convictions of the two House leaders last year, an ongoing federal investigation about the governor's economic programs. So there's a lot of talk about it. But I think the realistic expectation is very low right now, and some nibbling around the edges of the ethics issue.
So really it comes down to, as it almost always does, they're huddled and they're saying to each other, what's the least we can possibly get away with?
Well, you know, they seem to do a lot of changes that sort of change reporting requirements, but they're never a lot of changes that change one of the biggest issues, according to activists and academics and others, which is the influence of money in state politics.
Well, yes, and if you got there under the old rules, you are not very happy about changing the rules so that new people could contest with you. I mean, I think that that's part of it, obviously, and everybody knows where to go and what to play. But I was talking to one assemblyman the other day who said, you know, we think that basically we've got this thing locked. There's a proposal to pay, to allow us to make on the outside, in other words, on top of our income, to make 70% of what a state judge makes. Now, that is what, in the word, the Yiddish word, would be a verschlugene proposal. Where in the world do they come up with something that stupid?
Well, I don't know. They're probably trying to look for some rationale to tie something to a outside limit. But you know what is interesting is outside income is an important issue, but it's not necessarily the one that runs through the corruption trials that we saw last year with former Speaker Silver, former Majority Leader Skelos. I mean, one of the things that we saw a thread running through both of them was what's called the LLC loophole. What this is it's sort of a loophole that allows companies to donate virtually unlimited amounts of money through an unlimited number of LLCs, which are limited liability companies. In other words, subsidiaries. You could have the Alan Chartok company, and then you could spin off 10 subsidiaries and give the maximum through all of those. And actually, you could do as many as you want just to give money. And there's very little talk of them actually doing something about that. There's a number of legislators who have proposals on that issue, but that one never seems to get...
Well, that's all cover, right?
That one never seems to get serious.
Because they know that nobody's ever going to do them. You know, if you look in the real estate sections, one of my favorite things to see in the Times or other places, some of these places are bought by LLCs. The same thing. People don't want people to know who's doing the buy-in. So it gives you a certain amount of anonymity. I would take some issue with what you just said. I think in the Shelley Silver trial, certainly outside income had a great deal to do with it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying it didn't. Yeah. I'm not saying it didn't. But what I was saying is that the cooperating witnesses in both cases circled back to a Long Island real estate company that is the most prolific user of the LLC loophole.
Yeah. Well, one of the discussions that we've had around this table over the months since Andrew Cuomo inexplicably closed down his Moreland Act commission, which infuriated, obviously, Pete Bharara, who's still talking about it, was that there are people who think that the cover was coming off and that while Cuomo had named this commission to root out corruption, that he was getting sucked into it because he gets money from these LLCs.
Well, you know, I think that from the beginning, the governor's formation of that Moreland Commission a few years ago I think the real practical political purpose of that was to put a lot of pressure on the legislature.
That's what he says. I think also to make him popular with the public.
Sure. I mean, it looks good. I've got a commission going.
It did look good.
But I think that what proved out in the end was it was a mechanism to try to get them to agree to certain bills,
well, that's
all
what,
of which haven't made a whole lot of difference.
Well, Yancey, that's what he said. That's what he said. That was his cover. Mm-hmm. I never thought so. I always thought it was that they were getting close. And there was a spate of stories at the time that the real estate industry, which had made major contributions to the governor, didn't like the heat that was coming.
Well, it was clear that through the reporting that was made at the time by a number of terrific news outlets that the commission and the people running the commission kind of went off in whatever direction they wanted. And at some point, the governor's top advisors kind of reined them in.
One of the things, Yancey Roy, that is interesting is that when these commissions get constituted, whether it's what we call J. Cope, the Joint Commission, which is supposed to be running the ethics show, and that the governor almost inevitably puts his own man or woman at the head of these things, thereby making everybody hold their nose.
Well, J. Cope, the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, has certainly been plagued by complaints of lack of independence, even by its own commission members. And it's also certainly true that the staff running the commission has, by and large, come straight from the governor's administration.
Well, one really wonders whether or not the governor is thinking straight on that one, because it's one of those things that ticks people off. Look, this governor has decided he's going to be more popular with the left of his party. He's gone out with a whole range of programs which should appeal to them. But I think that his problem now is that he has a reputation as being sort of a bully. And to that, I want to ask you about the almost inexplicable thing that is going on with Mayor de Blasio. You know, the governor really keeps going after de Blasio. He won't stop. What is between those guys?
Well, you know, I couldn't say what exactly is personally between them. Obviously, anytime a mayor of New York and a governor of New York State, there's always going to be tension. There's always going to be competition for who's the big dog, so to speak, and who's calling the shots. And there are some folks out there who have ventured that when de Blasio stepped in and helped the governor secure the nomination of the Working Families Party back in 2014, it was a sort of a debt that the governor, say, owed the mayor sort of politically, and that didn't sit well with folks. And so in a way, you know, thanks for the favor. The payback was to not try to make things easy for the mayor whatsoever. Certainly what we've seen is the mayor at various issues, whether it's the pre-K issue, whether it's trying to get mayoral control of schools, a lot of important policy issues. And I think anyone would agree he hasn't gotten a lot of help from the governor, and it's putting it mildly, on a lot of those issues.
It seems personal. It seems petty to me.
De Blasio said that. He said it's a vendetta against him.
Well, I don't get it. I'll be honest with you. I just wrote a column in which I gave some advice to the governor. I said, these are the things I would do if I were you. One of them is stop this nonsense, because I believe it's the governor going after de Blasio, not the other way around. A lot of people dismiss it and say, well, these guys can't get along with each other. But I think de Blasio is more the victim than the aggressor here.
You know, one of the governor's tactics since he has been in office in 2011, whether it's the mayor of New York City, whether it's the state assembly, whether it's the state senate or any of the other elected statewide elected officers, is to try to keep them all guessing and off balance and sort of uncomfortable. And a colleague of mine, Dan Janison, a couple of years into the governor's tenure, wrote a column where he says, invoking the old Dos Equis commercial, the most interesting man on television says, stay thirsty, my friends. In Albany, the most powerful man says, stay nervous, my friends. And that's sort of
Preet Bharara, well as Andrew, right?
Yeah.
Well, because Preet Bharara looks at Andrew and says, stay nervous, my friend.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of a tactic that a politician, whether it's the governor or a U.S. attorney, you know, you want to keep people unsure, uncertain, keep them guessing as to where you're going next, not keep them comfortable. That is a way to sort of keep political leverage.
Speaking of which, I think Hillary Clinton did something stupid. I want your reaction to it. She was being interviewed, and somebody asked her whether, I think it was a softball question, whether she would reappoint Preet Bharara to be U.S. attorney. And she said it's too early to do to make those kinds of decisions. I thought that was stupid. Here's this guy who has turned New York on its head, who's done more anti-corruption stuff than anybody around, and she says something like that. I thought it was an arrogant and miscalculation on her part.
Well, you know, who knows what the dynamics are between, say, Bharara and the Clinton camp. Right. I mean, on the one hand, you could say a politician doesn't want to get into a set of circumstances where he or she is answering questions about appointments in the future because it may look presumptuous. And I think in general, that's why a politician doesn't do that. We'll see who runs this department or who runs that or whatever. But you know what's also interesting about that, Alan, is I think that Donald Trump would have handled that question differently.
Absolutely.
And not because it's a Republican-Democrat thing. It's because if you look at a lot of what he's doing on television, in the debates, on the trail, he does a lot of salesmanship techniques, which work well, which is about looking past the sale. He does a lot of things where he puts in your the listener's mind this image that he is already president, and here's what he's going to do. For example, he names Chris Christie the head of his transition team, as if he's already been elected, and he's on his way to the White House. And
he says he's going to go visit with whatever his name is, the Kim Il-jung, the head of North Korea.
Right, it's the whole very thinking past the sale technique of a salesman.
Yes, that's true. And there's one other facet to this that I think she should have known. Probably the most powerful Democrat in New York State or the country is Charles Schumer. Preet Bharara worked for Chuck Schumer. We all know that the senior senator of the same party as the president gets to appoint the U.S. attorneys, basically, and to recommend, but it was an appointment. So for her to say, it's too early for me to figure that out, it isn't too early because it was Schumer's call in the first place that Bharara get put in there, which I always have found very interesting. And it is Schumer who's going to make the next appointment.
It's true. And at the same time, knowing how political communications work, don't you sort of maybe just safely presume that at some point Clinton and Schumer have had some sort of little discussion about this, about what may or may not happen and what they want to say about it right now in May before the election?
Well, yeah.
I just think that, you know, I'm just guessing that a candidate like Clinton has probably given a signal, if not a direct, you know, answer to Schumer about where she's going or what he wants her to do or what she wants to do on that issue. And that's the difference between a private communication and a public communication.
Well, Yancey, you may be right to posit that. On the other hand, I've seen Hillary Clinton make plenty of mistakes, not the least of which is taking the money from all these companies to give speeches when you know you're going to be a Democratic candidate. That goes to a sort of a moral issue with both Clintons, in my opinion. And I think may have been a mistake. But, you know, I know Chuck Schumer well enough to know that what he's going to want, especially if turns out to be the Senate majority leader, the top cat in the Senate, is he is not going to be denied by Hillary Clinton or anybody else.
You know, I think it would be safe to presume if he wants Preet to stay in that office and if Hillary wins and he makes that clear, I would expect that that's what would happen then.
Okay, so here's a conspiracy theory for you. Chuck Schumer puts Preet into his office. He becomes the fighting U.S. attorney. He does incredibly wonderful things in Albany, turning things around in a way that nobody would have expected possible, interpreting the law. And he told me, I'm interpreting it, but I'm not making it. It's always been there. I'm, in fact, using it when he went after Silver and Skelos. So my issue when you look at all of this is that Schumer may have been interested in keeping the very aggressive governor at bay, which, of course, Preet has done.
Well, it sounds like that would be a great column for you, right? I mean, I don't know.
I write them and I forget them, so I'm not sure that I haven't written it already.
You know, what's interesting is, to your point about using the statute, a U.S. attorney much like a state attorney general, the agenda is set by the office holder. There's no sort of long list of prescription of must-dos for that kind of office. Unlike, say, a governor, where you have to have a budget, you have to do something for education, you have to do something for this topic and that. In large respects, the attorney general or a U.S. attorney can decide, I'm focusing on white-collar crime, I'm focusing on political corruption, I'm focusing on street crime or drug dealers or whatever. That is an office where the office holder can really tailor his agenda to his own leanings.
That's true. Hey, you write for Newsday, a wonderful newspaper from Long Island. I have this other theory, as long as I'm giving my theories today. And one of them is that it is New York City and Long Island and the enclosed burbs which have protected Andrew Cuomo, because he certainly did terribly upstate in all of these elections and primaries. So are you getting any feedback as to whether or not his popularity in your place in Long Island has dissipated?
Well, he won Nassau County in 2014, in part, I think, because he had forged a working relationship with the Republican County Executive, Ed Mangano. But he lost Suffolk County, which can tend to be a little bit more conservative. It's a little bit farther away from the city.
Yeah.
So I think there was
more ducks and potatoes.
Yeah. And there was a sort of a split verdict on him there. I think that sort of what's kind of interesting, and it's sort of the loop back into the whole corruption angle. I mean, Nassau and Suffolk County are both dealing with major corruption investigations that are going on, that's being carried out by the Eastern District of New York, the U.S. attorney out there. Similar sorts of things in terms of favored deals, favored contractors. And then in the case of Suffolk County, it's the members of the district attorney's office who are being targeted by the federal prosecutors for possibly, you know, running a prosecutor's office in a possibly corrupt way.
Yeah. That's why this whole business of federalism, which I always have talked to my students about, you know, having these two levels of sovereignty, the state and the federal government. If there was no federal government, you think about this, Yancey, if there was no federal operatives, none of this corruption stuff, Silver or Skelos and the other, would have ever been brought. We can pretty well posit, because the state tends to be very careful. The players tend not to want to alienate each other.
Well, and I think that is reinforced a little bit by the structure of oversight. You have a state elections board that is constituted in a way that has four members, two Democrats and two Republicans, and lo and behold, on most controversial issues, they split 2-2, and that means nothing happens on a lot of investigations.
Exactly.
The governor forced through a change in that the last time around they addressed that issue. But then again, the change was this. He got to appoint an enforcement council. And this enforcement council is the person who Bill de Blasio, as we alluded to earlier, is saying is tied to the governor and is bringing this case against him, and it's all reeks of sort of a political payback. And so to get back to the point, the State Board of Elections, the oversight that's put in by the state is kind of hamstrung by the way it's structurally conceived. The attorney general doesn't have, which presumably you might think, okay, an independently elected attorney general, that might be the office to place some of the responsibility to investigate this stuff, doesn't really have the leeway to do that. So if you're sort of hamstrung structurally and practically at the state level, well, it leaves it to an aggressive federal prosecutor to step in, again, if he wants to make that his agenda, to step in and do some of these political corruption cases.
So we have these two New Yorkers, Hillary Clinton. We only have 4 minutes, by the way, left. But we have Hillary
Clinton. Time flies.
Yeah, it does. You have Hillary Clinton. You have Donald Trump as the presumptive nominees. Hillary Clinton, as we speak this morning, is 100 votes, 100 delegates away. In other words, she's going to get it. Bernie Sanders is still fighting, but I'm assuming that it's going to be Hillary versus Trump. Have you thought at all about the implications of all of this for New York State?
Well, you know, isn't it kind of amazing that here we are, it's looking like 2016, the candidates from each party is going to be a New Yorker. You know, traditionally, the conventional wisdom for the Republican side was that a candidate from the Northeast won't win it, although Mitt Romney did win it, the party nomination in 2012, but that generally you had to have someone who was strong through the South, maybe carry, you know, some of the key states in play down there or maybe out west. It's kind of an interesting and fascinating thing that I don't think 10 years ago you might have had people thinking there would be any time in the near future where both candidates for the presidential, for the White House would be from New York. I think it's going to be fascinating. I think it's going to be fascinating, frankly, for New York media, honestly. I mean, we're going to have probably full out, full court coverage from our paper, from every outlet. It's going to be interesting, no matter what side folks are on. It's going to be interesting and dynamic if you're a resident of the state.
Yeah. You know, they used to say of some of these very powerful politicians, if they, Stanley Steingott, when he had been the speaker back in the day, that if you put one more thing in Flatbush, the avenue would sink. Well, this is a time for New York to get some goodies.
Well, that could be as well, sure. I mean, it's been a long time since the state had a president, for that matter, a presidential candidate.
Yancey Roy, I got two more minutes. I want to ask you, Todd Kominsky out on Long Island wins a special election by the skin of his teeth, as we have sometimes said. Mel Brooks' nephew, and as far as I was concerned, that was enough. But he wins. It's getting very close in the state Senate. You got 2 minutes. Will the state Senate go Democratic?
Well, you know, right now the Democrats have a majority numerically in the Senate, but they don't have the power, thanks to the power-sharing agreement with some of the renegade Democrats.
I call them the traitors.
It's going to be a very tough year for Republicans to hang on because traditionally a presidential year favors Democrats. Democratic turnout is better. They tend to do better. That said, it's also the track record makes it very difficult to bet against the Republicans.
And many of us think that the governor, being a Democrat, really wants the Republicans, like his father, to stay in office because it gives him a little break on the aggressiveness of the demands of the Democrat.
Given everything that's happened in the last year and given the fact that all of the headlines right now regarding the administration is about where is this federal investigation going, I wouldn't be surprised to see, frankly, not a lot of activity from the governor one way or another on the legislative elections this year.
Yeah, he sort of had his fangs pulled a little bit by the Barrera oversight, I suspect.
Well, you know, right now that's what everyone is focused on. And it's, you know, everyone is just waiting to see where this goes.
Where the next shoe falls
out. How wide it goes.
Buffalo.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, it's great to talk to our friend Yancey Roy, as I have said before, the best name in all of organized journalism and a keen and insightful guy when it comes to what's happening up here. Yancey, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Thank you.